Good morning to all. Good morning, everybody. We're going to call the meeting to order. Academic Research Student Affairs. Thank you very much. If we could all turn to the Pledge of Allegiance. Regent McMichael, will you lead us in the pledge?
The United States of America, and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Excellent.
Can I borrow you again? Lift that up again, please. Thank you. Thank you, Linda.
Winter, if you could please do roll call.
Chair Escada?
Here.
Vice Chair Del Carlo?
Here.
Regent Cruz Crawford?
Here.
Regent Goodman?
Here.
Regent McMichael?
Here.
You have a quorum.
Thank you so much. Start off with public comment. Is there any public comment in Elko?
There is no public comment in Elko.
Fantastic. Is there a public comment in Reno? Hearing none. Is there any public comment here at the College of Southern Nevada? Hearing none, seeing none. Let's move to consent items. Is there a motion on the table?
Motion to approve.
Motion by Regent McMichael. Second. Second by Vice Chair Del Carlo. Questions, comments? None heard. Seeing none, all in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion carries unanimously. Consent items, number two, for possible action. Let's start with letter A, minutes. Are there any corrections or comments? Seeing and hearing none. Any other comments? Do I have a motion for approval?
Motion to approve.
Thank you, Regent McMichael. Second. Thank you, Regent. Vice Chair Del Carlo. Questions, comments? Fantastic. I would like to first and foremost express my appreciation for our personal stenographers, Winter Lipson and Angela Palmer. What they do with the systems office is beyond reproach. I want to say thank you. These minutes are fantastic. Everybody, if there's all in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion carries unanimously. Let's go with letter B, TMCC program elimination. It's the AAS and dietitian technician for possible action. Is there a motion on the table for approval? Regent Del Carlo, Vice Chair Del Carlo, excuse me. Is there a second?
I'll second.
Thank you, Regent Cruz Crawford. Questions, comments? All in favor by saying none, hearing none. All in favor signify by saying aye. All opposed? Motion carries. Let's go to the letter C, the program elimination for the geoscience for possible action. Here, the TMCC will request an approval for the elimination of the Associate of Science of Geoscience. Any students wishing to pursue the path in geoscience can complete an AS of the emphasis in geology. Do we have any questions, comments from the committee members? Seeing none, hearing none. Actually, I do have one question. If a TMCC representative can come on up. Please, sir, identify.
Good morning, Regent Arascata. Jeffrey Alexander, Vice President of Academic Affairs from Truckee Meadows Community College, for the record.
Thank you, Dr. Alexander. Just a quick question. Have the four affected students been contacted by the academic advisor to ensure a smooth transition?
Yes, that's correct. They have, in fact, this motion comes as a result of the NSHE low yield report, which repeatedly has shown no majors in this program. And after some time, the college has decided to instead move to an Associate of Science with the possible choice of emphasis in geology, and recently hired a faculty member to teach in this program area who also has program designs in other arenas too.
Fantastic. Any additional questions for Dr. Alexander? Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Regent Arascata.
Any additional questions, comments from the board members? Seeing none, hearing none. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion carries unanimously. Let's jump down to number three. The UNLV program proposal for the Bachelor of Science Applied Health Sciences. And I can see Provost Evie walking up. Provost Evie, please, you're at the mic.
Thank you, Chair Arascata, Vice Chair Del Carlo, and Regents. Delighted to be before you this morning asking for approval of our new degree program in Applied Health Sciences. Like most of the campuses, I think, in the NSHE system, we've seen tremendous growth in our health science programs and demand for these programs. And sometimes these programs are limited in capacity, and so this program is designed to be a program that will serve all the students who want to go into these health science-related fields and will provide a foundation also for students who want to pursue programs that will be at the postgraduate level. And so we anticipate very strong demand for this program and that it will be a great platform for those who want to pursue degrees in the health sciences. Thank you. Happy to answer any questions.
And with that, are there questions on the floor? I'll take this one again. On page 15 of the report, you have an FTE proposal of 160 students at the onset of the first semester. Is this enrollment of optimism or confirmed student interest?
We have many students who come into the university right now seeking to pursue degrees such as medical imaging, health physics, etc., and they're considered pre-majors. And so these, in this new model, those students will enter into this applied health sciences degree. And so they will essentially, the degree will automatically have strong enrollment. Many of those students will matriculate out of the degree and pursue their specialty a degree that they're interested in, but those students who aren't able to get admitted will be able to finish their bachelor's degree and then pursue the credential they need post graduation.
Is this with both the online and hybrid, the hybrid delivery of this program?
Yes, we expect to be able to deliver it in both formats, and we'll have sufficient demand to basically have strong enrollment both in person and in the online offerings.
Excellent. And as a side note, I do strong applause for adding the three additional academic advisors. Well done.
Thank you.
Do we have any other questions, comments on the table? Seeing none, hearing none. Do I have a motion from committee, from a committee member? Regent DeCarlo, Vice Chair DeCarlo. Do I hear a second?
Second.
I'm going to go with Regent Goodman. First by Regent. No more questions, comments. Seeing none, hearing none. All in favor by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Hearing none. Motion carries unanimously.
Thank you.
Thank you, Regent Hebe. Let's go with number four. UNR program proposal for a Bachelor of Science in Early Childhood Education. I see Provost Thompson walking up. Provost, please. Microphone.
It's on. Oh, it's on. There we go. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the Board of Regents. My name is Jeff Thompson. I serve as the Executive Vice President and Provost at the University of Nevada, Reno. UNR is presenting for your consideration a new degree program, and it's sort of a new degree program, but I'll get to that. In early childhood education, it's a Bachelor of Science, and it will be offered through the College of Education and Human Development. And this degree is designed to address a need for well-prepared early childhood teaching professionals. The degree program is designed to prepare educators to teach young children from birth to second grade. It will prepare teachers to seek early childhood education licensure in Nevada or work in settings where licensure is not required, such as private childcare. The college and department will also seek accreditation from the National Association for the Education of Young Children if the program is approved. And the department has also worked with the Nevada Department of Education on curriculum and licensure requirements, and two new courses were also created to meet licensure requirements from the Nevada Department of Education. We've also worked with our partner institutions to make sure that there's a seamless transition for students who are interested in this degree program from WNC and TMCC from their programs. And this program would also replace an early childhood education track in our integrated elementary teaching program, but would create an accredited program for UNR. One of the goals also is to develop a diverse and well-prepared cadre of early childhood educators for all of Nevada and to meet the needs across our state. So thank you for your consideration. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Fantastic. Are there any questions on the table? Regent Cruz Crawford.
Thank you. Regent Cruz Crawford, for the record, I would like to share my support and also some research out of the American Educational Research Association. Students that participate in a high-quality pre-K program are 11.4% more likely to graduate high school, and they are 8.1% less likely to be retained. So I am in full support of this program, and I'm very excited about it as a supervisor and principal of an early childhood program at my school, or several programs. Thank you.
Vice Chair DelCarlo.
Thank you, Chair. I also want to say I'm very supportive of this. I'm glad to see it come back, and I hope down the road there's a new child care center somewhere on the campus that will greatly expand the capacity for our faculty, students, and staff. Thank you.
Thank you.
And I, too, have a couple questions. On page 8G, top of page 8, you had some statistics in regards to evidence of employment opportunities for graduates. And you did this on state and national. I want to compliment, strong statistic. But on page 13, I'm going to go with the same question I provided to Provost Hebe. Of the project of FTE of 60 students at the onset of the first semester, is this an enrollment of optimism, or is this a confirmed student interest?
Thank you, Chair, and I have to say this, but I do appreciate the question. We're always optimistic. We think it's a great program, and there'll be a lot of students in the program. But it's also based on students who are already in the integrated teaching program and the track, but also students in human development, family studies, and counseling who are already interested in early childhood education. And having a licensure program available for them, we expect that they will transition to that program. So it is based on current enrollments.
Okay. I'll take that. Thank you. Any additional questions for Provost Thompson? Seeing none, hearing none. Do I have a motion for approval?
Motion for approval.
First by Cruz Crawford, Regent Cruz Crawford. Second was Vice Chair DelCarlo.
Excellent. Sorry, I've seen if I have any others.
Do I have a motion for approval? We have the two. First by Regent Cruz Crawford, second by Regent, I think I said, Vice Chair DelCarlo. Let's go, seeing none, hearing. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries unanimously.
Thank you.
Thank you, Provost Thompson. Number five, Regents Awards for possible action. Apologize, let me cruise on down here. So there are numerous items on this. Item number five, we have subsection A, B, C, D. And I think it's important for these individuals to have recognition, to be named coming out. These individuals have been working diligently on our campuses for numerous years. And I'm just going to rattle off some of their names. And if they are present, please just raise your hand. If not, you're in our hearts. Number one, we're going to go with creative activities. We have Rachel Stiff with WNC, Adam Schroeder with UNLV. The Regent Teaching Award, Dr. Amy Grillieri, Dr. Elena Pavahasuv, oh, I knew I was going to butcher this, Pravo Suhaudova over at UNR, Dr. Lori Newman here over at NSC, Regents Academic Advisory Award to Gracia Anaya Arevalo up at TMCC, Carlos Brecklin at UNR, and Dr. Kristen Clements Noel over at UNR also. Regents Research Award, Dr. David Leitner of a UNR, and Dr. Dev Chidambaram over at UNR. Regents Writing Research Award, Dr. Christine Albano at DRI, Dr. Jennifer Byrnes at UNLV, Dr. Jason Flatt at UNLV, Dr. Shane Krause at UNLV, Dr. Julie Allen at UNR, Dr. Ethan Rice at UNR, and Dr. Rachel Herzl, Dr. Herzl Betts at NSC. I want to thank you. I want to thank each and every one of those individuals. What you do on our campus infuses us what we want to continue, positivity and education for the students. So thank you to all. Any other questions, comments from the committee members? Regent Goodman.
Well, I just would like to say that I personally work with Dr. Shane Krause, and he is exceptional, and so that just tells me that everyone on this list is just wonderful. This is so important, and this is the kind of stuff that makes me happy. So congratulations to everyone.
Excellent. Wonderful to hear. Do we have a motion on the table? Oh, sorry about that, Regent Cruz Crawford.
Chair Scotta, first of all, I want to thank you for all your work you put into this committee. I'm so proud to be in this committee. I would like to put in a request. I don't know if this is the appropriate time. I'm learning here. To put pronunciations of names on the documents, because I think it's very, very important that I would have done the same thing. So, but very important to say people's names the way they are supposed to be pronounced. So if we could have pronunciation, that would be great. Thank you.
A little phonetically would have been helpful. I agree. When I was reading these over last night, I was like, oh, I'm going to butcher this one. But anyhow, thank you. Yes. Regent Cruz Crawford, we'll unquestionably take that recommendation into consideration. So do we have a motion on the table? First by Vice Chair DeCarlo.
I'll second.
Second by Regent Goodman. Questions or comments? Excellent. Seeing none, hearing none. All in favor by signifying by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion carries unanimously. Number six, handbook revision, regulations for determining residency and tuition. Here we're going to have the interim vice chancellor of academic student affairs and community colleges, Renee Davis, will present for approval of this item. Please, Ms. Davis.
Thank you. Good morning, Regent Chair Arescotta and Vice Chair Del Carlo. Thank you. So the proposal we have today for you is basically a policy clarification and a reorganization of the existing chapter, Title IV, Chapter 15, Regulations for Determining Residency and Tuition Charges. The briefing paper does a really good job, I think, of laying out and summarizing each of the section changes, so I'm going to use that as a guide, but certainly if you have questions, I'm happy to answer those. So starting with Section 1, in this section, we add some new language to outline how the sections of the chapter should be applied. And there's basically an order there, a logic order. And it reflects current practice, but we felt like it really needed to be clarified in policy just to help make sure things are transparent and applied consistently by all of our campuses. In terms of that order, the first thing that we do when making a residency determination is we determine whether a student qualifies under one of the exemptions. And one of the most common exemptions is Nevada High School graduate. So if the student is a Nevada High School graduate, we look no further. they're a resident for tuition purposes. And then at the point, if there's nothing on that list where the student qualifies for an exemption, then they get put into the category where they need to demonstrate 12 months residency in the state. So it's kind of two buckets when we're doing that overall residency determination, so we wanted to make sure that was clear. And again, that aligns with current practice, very long-standing practice, but we think it's spelled out much more clearly now in this new version. Also in Section 1, something that was addressed but maybe not as completely is what to do when there's an institutional error. So it's really important for me to point out that this never has been the case, and it will not be under this new wording, that a student would be penalized for past decisions. Basically, if an error is found, and it's pretty rare, that is changed going forward, and the student's not penalized for anything in the past. So, but then going forward, the new correction is applied. So then I will go to Section 2. That one, we added a explicit definition of bona fide residence, which affects all the rest of the chapter. There are references to bona fide residence. In Section 3, there are a number of technical corrections, mostly wording to get things consistent. There's also a section that looks like it's coming out, but it's actually just being moved, and that's the section that has to do with the Federal Choice Act. It refers to covered individuals. And that was some language we had to add to the handbook several years ago, so we were in compliance with the federal law. It also does a little cleanup in terms of NRS 396.540. We're not adding any new categories here, but what we're doing is aligning it more specifically with the NRS. Section 4, we pull out all the language associated with the Choice Act and or pull into that section, apologies, that we took out of Section 3. Section 5 was the prior Section 4, and so we are pulling out of that section some language that we also want to break out separately, and that has to do with using the federal terminology, alien students. Then in Sections 7 through 10, it's just a simple renumbering. Section 11 was formerly Section 9. And there we add some language regarding the shared residency application. And we think that's really important because that helps maintain that consistency. It is current practice since about 2018. We've had a shared form. And we work very closely with the campus registrars to make sure we've gotten that right. And then that concludes all of the changes. I know it was a little fast, but I didn't want to go into too much detail because I know that, you know, it's early. We don't want to have a nap. So I'm happy to answer any questions should you have them.
Fantastic. And yes, that would put us in the weeds, but I know that all of our committee members unquestionably read the attached documents. So thank you. Any questions, comments?
Thank you, Chair. Laura Perkins here. Even though I know I'm not on this committee, I appreciate the clarity and the clarification because my daughter applied to UNLV a while before President Withfield, of course. But she was classified as an out-of-state student, and it was almost it took a stack of paperwork to correct it. Even though she was born here, she graduated from a Nevada high school, but still we had to go through it. A little bit of clarification processes, which was inconvenient at best, cumbersome, you know, at worst. But so I'm really glad to see this coming forward. Thank you.
Thank you for that add-on. Well done. Ms. Davis, thank you. I want to express our appreciation to you and the staff. This was very, very well done. Do we have any additional questions or comments on the table? Seeing none, hearing none. Do I have a motion for approval?
Motion to approve.
Thank you, Regent McMichael. Second. Vice Chair DeCarlo, thank you. Any additional questions, comments? Seeing none, hearing none. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion carries unanimously. Thank you, Ms. Davis. Appreciate your time. Let's go to number 7, the NSHE Common Course Numbering System. Speaking about putting us in the weeds, this is a good one. Coming up today, we have the Academic and Transfer Policy Analyst, David Singleton. Mr. Singleton, please continue.
Thank you, Regent Arascada. Good morning, everyone. For the record, David Singleton, Academic and Transfer Policy Analyst. And I'm here today to talk to you about Common Course Numbering and also provide a bit of a brief update on transfer initiatives. Believe it or not, Common Course Numbering policy kind of serves sort of as, I think, the foundation for allowing the daily work of educating our students to occur at our institutions. I will do my best over the next few minutes to keep us out of the weeds and not turn this into the econ class from Ferris Bueller's Day Off. And so I hope by the end, though, that you have sort of a basic understanding of how Common Course Numbering works, if I can get this to work. So NSHE initially adopted the Common Course Numbering policy in 2000. And so our Common Course Numbering master file or database tracks all of our undergraduate courses at the system level. So anything numbered from 001 up to 499 is included in that master file. So graduate courses, medical school, law school, dental school, all those courses are not under that master file system. And there are two different types of courses, so let me clarify that a little bit. There are unique courses, which are taught by only one institution. So an example of a unique course would be Journalism 121 Radio Production here at CSN. They're the only institution that teaches that class. A common course is something that is taught by at least two or more of the institutions. So Math 120, Fundamentals of College Math, is a common course because it is offered at all 7 of the institutions. The process is content-driven. So things like your assessments that you would use if you're using tests or papers or things like that are not part of the consideration for CCN. It is driven by what is actually being taught in the course. And the threshold for alignment is similarity of 80%. So, for example, all of the English 101 courses taught here in Nevada are at least 80% similar in content. By making sure that they're at that sort of 4/5 threshold, it allows for a more seamless transfer of courses between the institutions, but that 20% allows for faculty to cover different material but still addressing sort of the core content and learning outcomes that are needed for that articulation to happen. CCN is codified in the handbook and in our procedures and guidelines manual, but at its core, it is a faculty-centric and faculty-driven process. The faculty play a key role in making sure that, you know, the whole thing functions properly, and I'll kind of explain the role that faculty play as I move further into the presentation here. But first, we'll talk a little bit about, sort of at a broader level, who actually uses Common Course Numbering kind of policies. 20 states in the country have some kind of statewide Common Course Numbering policy, and that's according to the Education Commission of the states back in July of 2022. But I can tell you, though, that there are other states that are in the process of developing Common Course Numbering policies. At this point, the California Community Colleges are actually working on their own Common Course Numbering system across themselves, but the Cal State systems and the UC systems are not adopting that. And I know about that. What's happening in California, actually, because a couple of the community college districts in California actually contacted me to talk about our CCN process and how we run things, and they were actually a little surprised by some of the things that we are able to do here with CCN in the system. Now, I said that 20 states have some sort of CCN policy. 14 of those states, the policy is driven by state law or the legislature. 6 states do not have CCN policy derived from state law, and we are one of those 6. So on some level, when our board decided to adopt this back in 2000, it was something that was undertaken by, at the time, this body and this group. So having that initiative, it really shows that Nevada is a little bit on the leading edge as far as thinking about policies and procedures that are going to impact student success and student transfer. So oversight of the CCN process per the policy is delegated to a group called the Articulation Coordinating Committee. And so they are kind of in the center of this little CCN oversight slide that we have here. The Articulation Coordinating Committee meets up to 9 times a year, and the committee is made up of one representative from each of the 7 teaching institutions. Now, the members of the committee include transfer advisors, their curriculum coordinators who are part of it, assessment and planning staff, and registrars. As the academic and transfer policy analyst, I serve as the chair designee of the committee, and I currently report to the current interim vice chancellor of academic and student affairs and community colleges, because we all love our lengthy titles here. But not only do I serve as the chair of the ACC, but I'm also responsible for day-to-day management of the master file system. So that includes making some of the updates and changes as course proposals work through the process. So that's kind of sort of the system-level oversight of CCN, but it's also managed at the campus level, too, through some of those curriculum coordinators who actually run the process on each campus, and they work with the institutional faculty to make sure that the proposals are reviewed in a timely manner. Because of the role that faculty play, the rhythm of the process kind of aligns with our general academic calendar. There are two basic periods of the year when the process is open for business, for lack of a better term. The fall window is from August 15th to December 15th. The spring notification window, if we want to call it that, is from January 20th to May 15th. And because this is faculty driven, we want to make sure the process aligns when faculty are around on campus. There are four possible sort of transactions that can occur. Institutions can delete or remove offerings from their catalog. So if they are no longer wanting to teach a course, there's a form that they would fill out. It gets routed to me, and then that course is removed from the master file system. So if CSN, for example, wanted to stop teaching that Journalism 121 course, fill out a form, send it to me, it's removed from the master file system. They take it out of their catalog, and the class isn't offered anymore. The other transactions, course changes, which would be changing like the title or the number of credits that a course is worth, offering a unique course or already commonly numbered course, so course offering addition, and then the creation of unique brand new courses. Any of those other transactions require notification to be sent to the campuses. And that's really where that curriculum coordinator and faculty part of the process comes into play. So when a notification is sent out from one of the institutions desiring to do something, a clock starts. The other institutions have 10 business days to respond to either agree with that proposal or to voice an objection. In our process, the way that it works, if an institution doesn't respond, that's considered an affirmative. So if you do not respond to a request, so if I, as UNLV, wanted to start offering a course and UNR did not respond, that is saying yes. So no response is an affirmative in this process. Once those 10 business days have passed, the originating institution submits the form to me, and I update the master file within 14 business days. And again, like I said, outside of course deletions, each submission is reviewed by faculty at the other institutions. Most of the time, course creation, course changes proceed without a hitch. Most of the time. But if there is an objection, there's a process that we use to resolve that conflict, and that's what an academic discipline meeting is. Yes?
Quick question for you. You're mentioning that if there is not a response, that is taken as an affirmative?
Yes.
Do you all follow up with the campus just to make sure and clarify that they receive the communication, or no answers, no answer?
No answers, no answer.
Okay.
No answer is no answer. There, I think, is just the way that the process has evolved. There's not a double check. There are times where there has been a follow-up later on that may be voicing a concern, but in those cases, it may rise to this level where we then bring in this academic discipline meeting process.
Is there multiple options or multiple attempts to notify the campuses?
Once the initial is sent out, that is the start of the clock. Clock starts. So it's up to each process. Campus does the process a little differently. There may be chasing down that occurs. I am not in the loop for those notifications. So okay. If that dialogue is happening, that may be a departmental or curriculum coordinator level decision. So
we'll follow up on that. Thank you.
So, but the discipline meeting, if there is an objection or if there is a concern and it's written within that 10-day business day window, that's what we use to try to resolve the problem. Now, ideally, the discipline meeting, the academic discipline meeting, because I need to move away from just calling it discipline because now it sounds like punishment. The academic discipline meeting is really kind of the last resort, because ideally we want the institutions to work things out amongst themselves. We are a small system, and we can have that latitude, and ideally we have that collegiality and that collaboration to allow our faculty to talk to each other. It should only get to this point if there is really kind of an impasse that is reached, and that's what this is. The idea of the discipline meeting is that the faculty from who all teach within that discipline within the institutions are brought together to discuss the objection and find a resolution. Sometimes it results in the proposal being allowed to go forward as it is. Sometimes it results in that proposal being pulled. It's really handled on a case-by-case basis. But ideally, the resolution is met in that meeting. My role in that academic discipline meeting process is really to bring the faculty together, kick off the meeting, but it's up to them to actually run it. I have a decade of experience as an academic advisor, and then 5 years here at the system office. I was an advisor at all three of the southern institutions down here. So I know a bit about a lot of different areas, but I am not faculty. I never tried to be faculty. It is really up to the faculty. They know their curriculum. They know that discipline. And so we really count on them to be the ones to look at the proposal, figure out where an agreement can be reached and made. And this is kind of the thing I tell them when I kick off the meeting. I don't know this stuff. I don't know these fields, especially science. You don't want me kind of messing around in here under the hood because something might blow up. So we really count on you all as the faculty to be the ones to reach a resolution and figure out, is this course proposal okay? Does it need to be revised? Does it need to be pulled? Or does it need to be aligned with an already existing course? And that's really kind of what we're trying to look at, is trying to keep it. It's a time-intensive process, and it requires labor, but the benefit for the faculty should be simplifying and streamlining course development. So again, if you're trying to create a new course and you look at the database and see, oh, well, there already may be a course that exists, I don't have to create a brand new course. We can just align with something that's already being offered at one of the other institutions. Or if you think it is distinct enough, we have that 80% threshold that allows then for you to say, okay, I know it has to be this much more different from the already existing course in order for my class to proceed forward. So the parameters for course development are in place if you want to align or if you want to have your own unique course. Also, when new program proposals are submitted and come before Academic Affairs Council and then before this committee, the institutions usually have their semester-by-semester course outlines in the proposal, so that kind of illuminates for everyone what are the things that a student would need to achieve in order to complete this program. And while it is faculty-centered, and I've talked about the role that the faculty play, there are benefits for the students, again, primarily when it comes to the degree requirements and the coursework that students take, particularly in the first 2 years. My son is a current sophomore at Pinecrest Sloan Canyon, and so he has just applied to do dual enrollment, possibly here at CSN. And so talking with his counselor at his high school about CCN, because they did the little presentation, and I tried to explain about, okay, well, here's what transferability means, and here's what how Common Course numbering works and helps those students. Because you can sit with, as an advisor, you can sit with someone and say, hey, I know you're a high school student, you're in this dual enrollment program. If you think about going to UNLV or something like that, well, these courses will go to UNLV and they'll transfer. And that works for any of our concurrent or dual enrollment students, as well as for the students here who are not necessarily pursuing their full associate's degree. They know it transfers, and they would know in many cases the exact requirement and exactly how it's going to move over to the four-year institution. But it also helps in the development of the transfer agreements that we have and the work that we did in that area. If CCN didn't exist, if UNR was trying to work on transfer agreements with TMCC, WNC, and GBC, they would have to work out individual sort of course-by-course articulations to build those agreements. Well, because we have CCN, a lot of that work is already achieved. And so those agreements and the creation of those agreements was able to be facilitated because the Common Course numbering database. It makes the transfer pathway clear for students. And so this is where I'll do a little dovetail. So we're going to kind of detour a little bit. I'll talk a little bit about transfer. I joined the system office in April 2018, so I've been here about 5 years. In that time, I was called the Transfer and Articulation Ombudsperson, and part of my work at that point was our transfer agreement audit. Literally, I was just reminiscing with someone that on my second day in the office, we had a meeting talking about the upcoming transfer agreement audit in 2018. That work was ultimately completed in 2019-20 during that academic year. And at that point, we wound up with 593 of these regional transfer agreements. A regional transfer agreement, for those who don't know, is an agreement between the institutions in a region. So down south, it would be CSN to UNLV and Nevada State. Up north, it would be TMCC, GBC, WNC going to UNR, so that 2-year to 4-year agreement. At the end of our audit cycle, what we wound up with, of those 593 transfer agreements, 95.4% met board policy for transfer with no or minimal loss of credit to students. That doesn't mean, though, that 95.4% of our students transfer. If they did, my phone would be ringing off the hook from all these other institutions calling, wondering how we were able to achieve that. So that's not our transfer rate. It just means that the agreements that we designed, 95.4% of them comply with board policy. And that was a lot of work. And it was a couple of years of work. But we also are still trying to maintain the momentum. So while we are not doing audits of transfer agreements, full audits of transfer agreements, because I am a one-person office, monitoring of the agreement still occurs. The revised agreements are typically posted along with the next year's catalog so that students can make sure that they know about the requirements and possible changes that could affect them. As I mentioned earlier, when new program proposals are developed, one of the requirements for bachelor's degree proposals is that the regional transfer agreements be included. And the ACC doesn't just oversee sort of the CCM process. They also play a role by discussing the transfer and articulation issues and challenges, trying to problem solve issues and challenges if and when they occur. In my role as the academic and transfer policy analyst, I started holding back in November what I call office hours, where I set time specifically aside once or twice a month during the CCN notification window to be available to campuses to answer questions and concerns about the process and transfer and articulation. Now, this doesn't mean that they can't reach out to me at any time, and many of them often do anyway. But this is really just kind of a dedicated block of time where I am on Zoom in my office ready for people to come if they have questions. And it's open to faculty and staff. And so if you need me to, if you're looking at proposing a course and there's a syllabus because it's a common course number and you want to develop it because your institution doesn't have it, I can look and see if we have that in our files, and I can send that to you. And so I'm available for faculty as well as for staff for that. But we've also had conversations about expanding transfer beyond transfer agreements. And the agreements were important, and getting them refined was crucial work in addressing some of those perceptional issues of transfer that were out there. But agreements are only part of the toolbox. And so we need to really be thinking about supporting transfer students in a more holistic manner. And so in light of that need to address that, back in September, thanks to a grant that they received from the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, UNR held a statewide convening to kind of address these issues. And that was the NCHHMI Meet STEM Pathways Conference, which was held on September 21st and 22nd at the Student Union at UNR. Each of the institutions sent up a team of staff as well as some faculty to attend the conference. It was a working conference where we really got to talk about transfer in the state of Nevada, what it looked like. There was a presentation on some data points and conversations about what are the things that we can do to support our students in the transfer pathway and along the whole line from start to finish. It was STEM focused. But really, some of the applications could also apply to other students as well. And that was really kind of what we thought. The group, and there were seven, each institution had their own team. There was an average of 3 sort of action plans that were developed by per institution. So we wound up with 22 heading out of there of plans and ideas and thoughts to for the campuses to take back to help transfer students wherever they may be on their journey. So that was great. And, you know, I appreciate the work that went into doing everything we've done over the last few years to help our transfer students. And so I count on the institutions will continue that work. There's a steering committee that kind of is coming out of that to kind of help with the initiation of some of the plans. Now that we've got these ideas, how do we then put them into action? And so I know the institutions will work on that. But I'm going to bring it back to CCN here to close out and think about some of our future planning for CCN. And so some possible considerations we have is, while CCN is currently sort of focused on the content, it would be nice if we could think about the integration of how student learning outcomes also play into that and making that so that those are visible as courses are added to the master file. In ACC, we often have conversations about what are some of the things that we can do to improve the process and possibly shorten the timeline for getting courses added to the database, looking at a blue sky sort of conversations that we've had about a new master file system, which might include a mechanism to improve the workflow process, which right now is conducted through email chains with Word docs and PDFs. In that visioning of that we've had of the master file system, it might include prompts to remind people that, hey, this proposal was sent out. There's only 5 days left, so this is the time. If you have something to say, here's your opportunity to respond. To help keep faculty engaged in the process, we're also looking at increasing the frequency of the discipline meetings to allow the space for the faculty to come together and dialogue and talk about not just, you know, student learning outcomes and course development, but also thinking about what we can do as far as, are there courses, again, that need to be deactivated, removed from the system, things like that, so that there's space and availability as far as numbers go for future course development. And so hopefully that didn't go too far into the weeds and we didn't get too far off track. So thank you for the time today and listening to me to talk about CCN. I kind of get a little worked up when I talk about this, so I apologize if I seem a little too enthusiastic. I'm also a New Yorker, so I talk with my hands a lot. But I'm open to any questions you may have.
Great job. Great job. And please don't minimize what you're doing. You say you're a one-person office. You're working extremely well and extremely hard, so don't think it goes unrecognized. Regent Cruz Crawford, please.
Thank you, Chair Escada. First of all, Mr. Singleton, you and I could nerd out about this all day long, so we'll talk offline. Okay. But this is really an equity issue. So when our students that are first-generation high school students take a course, and then the course number is equivalent at another NC university or system, and they don't have the same course number, they might retake a course that they don't need to take. And we know when students take courses that are first generation that are not needed, they are more likely to drop out. Mm-hmm. So this is very important. I work at the state level helping teachers gain licensure and looking through transcripts for course completion needed to get licensing is a big hurdle for me between universities. And it really comes down to sometimes a subjective discussion on my part with an analyst at the State Department. This would alleviate that. It's also a workflow issue. Mm-hmm. If we are not getting our students out in a timely manner, they're not joining the workforce. Mm-hmm. So I think that needs to be stated. If you take, I don't know, biology 223, I don't know if that's a class.
It is a class. It's an anatomy and physiology one. It is okay. In health sciences. Any health science student, they're in that class.
So just to put this in layman's terms, if you take biology 223, it should be the same at every NC university. There is no reason why we should stop that, except, this is my question, this is a lot on the faculty's hands. Mm-hmm. So faculties have to dissect, they have to dissect syllabuses, evaluate them, they have to align them, and possibly rewrite them if they don't meet that 80% threshold. What are we going to do to compensate our faculty that are working on doing this work?
That's a question.
That's not up to you?
That's beyond my scope at this point.
Anyways, we'll talk offline. My daughter also goes to CSN High School. She's graduating this year. We'll talk. Yeah.
Thank you, Regent Cruz Crawford. I'm going to go to Vice Chair Del Carlo first, please.
Thank you, Chair. David, it's really great to see you. I remember when you were hired and put the brochure together, and when I ran in 2016, this was one of the core things I ran on. I couldn't understand why, if we had a state system, why 100% of our classes weren't transferable, because I had friends come to me saying their kids took a class at wherever, but it didn't transfer to the other institution. So I really appreciate your presentation and all the work you've done the last few years. To have a 95.4% transfer rate is terrific. I go to the National Association of Community College Trustee meetings, and we are always talking and comparing ourselves. And when I tell them we have 95.4%, they're blown away. And I see this as the core of what we do, the value of a system. It brings down the silos. But the biggest part here, and you pointed it out, Regent Del Cruz Crawford, is that it's up to the faculty working together. And I just want to do a shout out to our hardworking faculty to thank them for the work they do. I'm a proponent of continuous improvement, and I really believe that our goal should be 100%. And if we're at 95.4%, I would love to see this come back like in a year to where we can use this 95.4 as our baseline and then have continuous incremental improvement until we get there. Because if you've got 593 classes that meet this, then you know how many that don't. Mm-hmm. So I would say start chipping away at it with the faculty, and if we have to get involved at a higher level, just let us know, because this is really, really important. It leads to everything we do, especially the success of our students.
Yeah, and we want to get the number of agreements that completely meet board policy to 100%. There are some moving parts that are, I think, beyond sort of the scope of what we do in state. Some of it is because of requirements. There may be accreditation requirements and things like that that kind of affect and don't allow for the full meshing. But in those cases, that's where we can try to encourage institutions to think about the collaboration, whether it is utilizing our reverse transfer policy more or some of those other mechanisms, so that while it may not be fully at the raw number at 95.4% compliance with the transfer agreements, in practice, we can get that more towards 100.
Great points, Vice Chair O'Connor. And also, if I can please give the encouragement, hold on to that until new business, the encouragement. Thank you. Regent Perkins.
Thank you, Chair Arascada. I'd like to echo what my colleague said about the hard work, the faculty, and this is part of the systemness that we're always talking about, how we can work together as a system and better as a system. My question is, will there be like parent-child course coordination?
There is already parent-child course coordination. Okay. There are parents in the database. There actually is a notation in the master file if the courses are parent and child. So, and we do indicate that a parent course is created. If the child then exists, it will refer back to itself. Sometimes I have to do updates as far as manually inputting like the descriptions just to make sure everything lines up. But it is already indicated in there. So that biology 223 is the parent course actually for kinesiology 223. And it'll indicate that in the master file under kinesiology. It'll have a note that says parent course bio 223 so that you know what the links are.
Awesome, because that was a concern. If you start your coursework in 2000, by 2011, the coursework has changed, and you need to be able to go back and refer to that. So, thank you. Thank you for that.
Any other questions, comments? This was an information item. Well done. Very informative.
Thank you.
Great job. Thank you. I'm going to slide down to item number 8, the INSHE fee waivers. This has been proposed to us, and a lot of information has come down the pike over the past 2 years. And today in front of us, we have research analysis Jose Quialga, who will present the metrics for us on recipients of the various INSHE fee waivers. Please, sir.
Continue. Good morning. Jose Quiroga for the record, research analyst, academic and student affairs. Thank you to Chair Escada and to the board. members for the opportunity to talk about this topic. Like my colleague Dave said about course numbering, I could talk about ways to fund student education all day. So I will also try to keep mine as brief as possible. Today's presentation is a follow-up to a report submitted to the board in September of 2022. That report had a focus on the history of fee waivers, legislation that affected those fee waivers, and the evolution of those waivers over time. So I will try to keep it as brief as possible. There's a lot more information on that background in that waiver, and I have a link in a future slide. At that time, when the report was submitted, we only had aggregate information on those waivers at the system level. So we could only report, apart from the qualitative information, we could only report aggregate data, how many students had received the waivers and how many dollars had been waived. What we began at the behest of board members who wanted more information and to be able to hear more about what students we were serving, outcomes, is we began collecting student-level information so that we could match it with outcomes, with demographic data. So today I'll be able to go over not just the recipients, the dollars that were waived, but also biodemographic info and fall to spring data. So far we only have 1 year's worth of data, but we will continue to collect that year to year, and as we have longer data, we'll be able to give more robust measures of student success, like fall-to-fall retention or persistence, degree completion, and other measures. So with that, let's dive right in. And let's go over what fee waivers are and what they're not. The fee waiver is a release, either fully or partially, of the requirement to pay certain fees. Usually, for most fee waivers, that is the base registration fee and sometimes other fees. And as we go through each fee waiver, I'll discuss exactly which fees are being waived. Now, the fee waiver is different from other types of financial aid because a fee waiver, at least in Nevada, is unfunded. It results in foregone revenue by the institutions. Whereas traditional financial aid, grants, scholarships, even loans, work study, and grants and aid, those all have a funding source so that there is no foregone revenue. The bodies that have authorized fee waivers or that have the ability to do so are the Board of Regents. That was the case for the Foster Youth Fee Waiver. The state legislature, which has approved most of the current fee waivers, and NC institutions only with a prior approval by the board. And I will talk about the active duty fee waiver that is one that institutions can opt into. The cost of fee waivers has increased over the years from $2.5 million about 5 years ago, 2017-18, all the way to $3.6 million, a little over that, by 2021-22. So there has been some growth there. And I will, in this slide is where I have included a link to that longer report that really goes over that history that I will not have time to go over today as much as I could speak about it all day. So with that, I will dive into each fee waiver. I will give just the most salient points. Happy to answer any questions on those, however. The National Guard fee waiver is the longest established fee waiver that's currently in operation. It was adopted in 2003 by the Nevada legislature, and it serves Nevada National Guard members and, in some cases, their spouses or dependents, as well as their surviving spouses or dependent in certain cases. It serves undergraduate and graduate students. Importantly, it does not apply to professional schools, and I'm pointing that out because that will be different with other fee waivers. And it waives the base registration and most laboratory fees, certain laboratories fees. Oh, one more thing that I will say about the National Guard fee waiver, we'll see it in a future slide, but it is our largest by far fee waiver, and I will point that out later on. in 2009, and I'm going through these chronologically, in 2009, the POW-MIA fee waiver was adopted. It is for the children or spouses of active or service members that were prisoners of war, missing in action, or killed during the course of duty. I will say, thankfully, due to the tragic circumstances around this, it is a very rare fee waiver. In the last 5 years of data that I looked at, no students have been awarded this, but it is in policy, so a student could receive this. It very similarly to the National Guard fee waiver, it covers undergraduate and graduate level programs, except for those professional schools, and it waives base registration and certain lab fees. As we looked at 2014, this fee waiver is different in a couple of different aspects. It is unique in that it was established by the Board of Regents as opposed to by the legislature. And it was established at the behest or at the request of UNLV. At the time, they were looking at how to better serve members of active duty that were at the Nellis Air Force Base. This waiver was adopted by the Board of Regents to include active duty members who are permanently stationed in Nevada or at the nearby Mountain Training Center at Pickle Meadows, California. And UNLV and CSN adopted the program in order to serve those students. So it was for a special population in a region of our state. It serves undergraduate and graduate level students, same level of programs. However, the big difference is that it is only for special course fees, student fees, and other mandatory fees, not the base registration. The reason for that is that active duty members usually have benefits that cover only base registration and not the other mandatory fees. So this was meant to address that gap that existed for that group of students. In 2018, the Foster Youth Fee Waiver was adopted again by the Board of Regents. This was to serve students who were in the custody of a child welfare agency in Nevada. At the time, it was for students that were 16 years or older, and that has decreased to 13 years or older. It serves the same level of programs that we have talked about so far, undergraduate, graduate students, except for certain professional schools. And it waives base registration and certain lab fees. This program, however, has something that's really great, which is some philanthropic funding. It does not fund the actual waivers. What it funds is support structures around these students, including at the system level a foster youth ambassador position, the hiring of student workers who experience foster care to give them not just ability to support other students, but professional experience, workshops, lots of support around them. I will mention that this is the only fee waiver that has that funding. However, many of our institutions have instituted support structures around the populations served by the other fee waivers. Especially, I would note the Native American fee waiver that many of our institutions have built that without funding. In 2019, the Purple Heart fee waiver was adopted. This is another one that is more rare. In the 2021-22, only one student received it. And in previous years, it has been around that number, one or two students at a time. It is for members or veterans of the armed forces who receive the Purple Heart fee waiver. One unique item to this is that Purple Heart recipients or people who have earned the Purple Heart do not have to have a tie to Nevada. They do not have to have been stationed in Nevada or have any of those requirements that most of our fee waivers do have. It is for undergraduate and graduate programs. Importantly, it is the first fee waiver that includes law school, medical school, dental school. And we will see that in a future program as well. This was adopted again by the Nevada legislature. And another unique point, it not just waives registration and lab fees, but also all other mandatory fees. So that is a change in how waivers were traditionally implemented. I highlight here that it's for state-supported courses only. I will say that is true for all of our fee waivers. They are only for state-supported courses, not for self-supporting courses. And very importantly, even though this is a small program, I highlight it because it's true of the next program we'll talk about too, is the last dollar nature of it. The last dollar program, instead of waiving the base registration fee, it can do so, but if there is federal aid, let's say a Pell grant or a SEOG grant, if a student had, let's say, a $1,000 to $1,000 of tuition, registration fees, and a Pell grant paid for $750, the waiver would only cover that difference, the $250 left. So it first applies federal aid, and the waiver only covers the remaining. So that is, again, a change to how other fee waivers were previously adopted. And the latest program that was adopted was the Native American Fee Waiver Program. This was established by the Nevada legislature in 2021. It is for members of federally recognized Indian tribes or nation, all or part, which are in Nevada, or descendants from those tribes or nations. It does require a student to have lived in Nevada for at least 1 year. We have heard some feedback that can be an issue for Native American members who live across the border in maybe Idaho or California, went to a Nevada school, but are not residing yet in Nevada for 12 months. That is, it was established by the Nevada legislature, and I know that they are looking at that piece of it. It covers, again, like the Purple Heart fee waiver, it covers all undergraduate-graduate programs, including professional schools, and it waives all mandatory fees, including base registration and all other fees. And it is also a last dollar program. So if a student receives federal aid, it does reduce the fees that are waived by that amount. Okay, so now we can get to the data. This is an overview of the recipients for the 2021-22 year. You will see the Nevada National Guard fee waiver is the largest program. It is the longest serving program. We have a lot of National Guard members in our state, and this program has been able to serve them. In the middle tier of number of students and amounts waived are the foster youth and the Native American fee waiver. I will highlight that the Native American fee waiver is newer, so I would, though I haven't looked at data for newer years, I would expect that to continue to hopefully grow as more students are able to take advantage of that program over time. And I will note that the active duty military fee waiver, you will see that it has a large number of students but a small amount waived, and that is because of how it works, that it only waives those additional fees, not base registration. So this is the kind of data that we were not able to talk about last time that we presented fee waivers to the board. And it is student-level data that we matched with biodemographic data that we had. We see that our fee waivers serve students at a higher male, or fee waiver population has a higher percentage of male students than female. That is different than our overall ENCHI population, where we know it's, you know, roughly a 40 to 60 split with more female than male. That is driven by especially by the Nevada National Guard fee waiver. That population is majority male. The other programs are majority female. And I will also note in here that currently our data collection is limited to male-female. We are working with all of our institutions to be able to report wider gender data that we can then report to the board in future presentations. Then as we look at ethnicity, I will not go over every single column here, but you can see the difference between our waiver population and our overall ENCHI population. I'll highlight that first column, the American Indian or Alaskan Native area, where we can see that at the ANSI population, it is only 0.6% of our overall population that identifies as American Indian or Alaskan Native, whereas, especially because of the Native American fee waiver, our waiver recipients are represented at a much higher level. So that, I think that shows the value of that type of fee waiver and the students that we are serving. The most of the other categories are some slightly higher, some slightly lower, but much closer to the overall population. I will highlight the last column of historically minoritized students, that it does represent a higher percentage than our overall population. And finally, because we have 1 year of student data, so far we are only able to show fall to spring persistence. For all fee waivers, it is slightly lower than for our overall undergraduate population, degree-seeking population. As we dig into that deeper, we see that the Native American fee waiver recipients actually have the highest percentage or persistence rates. Part of that may be that a lot of these students are enrolled at the university level, more full-time. However, it is still a really great thing to see that fee waiver population has such a high percent persistence rate. At the low end, we have the active duty fee member, active duty fee waiver recipients. Active duty students have a full-time, usually much more than full-time job with the military, and may be deployed, may go away from the state, so they have a lot more barriers in continuing fall to spring. So they do have our lowest persistence rate. I want to highlight that this is a beginning and not an end to this kind of data collection, so that, as I said before, as we get more years of data, we'll be able to give more robust measures of student success. Finally, as we look forward, there are a couple of reporting opportunities to talk more about these kind of fee waiver programs. The first will be a member of my department, our Foster Youth Fee Waiver Report, or Foster Youth Fee Waiver Ambassador, will be up here to the ARSA committee at the June meeting and present an in-depth report with qualitative and quantitative data on that fee waiver. In September, the Native American Fee Waiver Report is due to the legislature, and we will continue both as requested, and whenever I get the opportunity to talk about this, I'll be happy to do so in the future. So thank you again to the chair and to the committee for the opportunity to talk about this. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Questions from the committee?
I have a question.
Regent Michael, please.
Yes, I see all the categories for the waivers. Is there a specific category for a Congressional Medal of Honor winner?
Jose Quiroga, for the record, there is currently not a fee waiver for Medal of Honor recipients. No, sir.
I know that it's probably highly unlikely that a recipient would be in the state of Nevada, but I would like to see that category opened up, you know, for a Congressional Medal of Honor winner, where no fees or tuition.
Thank you, Regent McMichael. Great suggestion. Regent Cruz Crawford, please.
Regent Cruz Crawford, for the record, I did want to share some impact numbers. So I wanted to clarify active duty. A lot of times they do not complete because they go to other institutions outside the state. But as a Nevada National Guard officer, the impact of our students that graduate college, according to a College Board research study in 2009, pay $7,000 more a year in taxes. So if 1,190 of those students graduate, we'll be putting $8.3 million back into the state of Nevada. And I think that's really important, because when we look at $3.7 million or whatever the cost is, it's a lot. But we're doubling over our lifetime, more than doubling year by year, with them having higher paying jobs. So I've seen a huge impact on my airmen. So I just wanted to state that.
Great statistics. Thank you. Any other questions, comments? Quick question. Oh, please, Chair Regent Downs.
Thank you, Chair Arascata. So this is just a kind of a more conversational question, but you mentioned it's the last dollar funding. So just from a theoretical perspective, what happens if everyone's last dollar funding? How does that apply? Which gets paid first?
Jose Quiroga, for the record, thank you for the question. It is, if it's last dollar funding, just to clarify, I believe your question is if there are two last dollar funding sources. It would, as with most financial aid, the question can be, it depends. That would be the answer. However, usually one will take precedence. You would have to figure out which one. And if two things are last dollar funding, they can't both apply, right? So one would usually cover everything. We've run into that when a student may qualify for two fee waivers. It's rare because these are very unique populations. But only one fee waiver would be covering all of it, potentially.
So that does happen, though?
We've run into the question. Okay. I don't, at least from our campuses. So usually that only happens if a student has asked the question. But that could happen. What does happen is a student may receive a scholarship that says we only cover, that scholarship donor only wants to cover registration fees, say. And in that case, again, if a scholarship is only going towards registration fees and a waiver is only applies to a scholarship, it would create a last dollar situation as well.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Mr. Chair.
No. Regent Boylan, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not on this committee, but I have a question, a couple of them. Is the fee waiver for the Native American population, is it mandated or is it just something we do?
Jose Quiroga, for the record, Regent Boylan, the Native American fee waiver is mandated by the Nevada legislature.
That means we get some money from them for it?
Jose Quiroga, for the record, no, sir, we do not. So far, all fee waivers that have been mandated have not had a funding source attached.
One more question, Mr. Chair. And I know this is politically incorrect, I guess, and I should not say it, but I will. Is there any way that we can approach the casinos that are owned by the Native Americans? They've just bought up the property where we had the biggest shooting in America, most people killed, and the bombs. So there's plenty of money there. So is there any way that we can approach those casino owners to help us fundate that mandate that the legislature so easily says, well, this is mandated, now screw you, you deal with it. Again, we are taking taxpayers' money and giving it away free. So that's, who would be, I don't know, is Dale, I mean, Mr. Chancellor, you or someone?
Let's do this. Let's go ahead and focus on that question.
Yes.
And then possibly we can put that under new business.
Oh,
then
I see.
We can get a little bit more information on it in the future.
Good idea. Thank you, sir.
My pleasure. Three of the items that you touched upon, and I'm going off the 2021 session, I believe it was AB 152, 162, and Senate Bill 2-something. You touched upon all those. It was the Native American fee waiver, the Air Guard fee waiver, and the Foster Youth fee waiver. And Regent Boylan just took the steam out of my sail. Is correct. Those are all unfunded mandates at this time. If we can receive an update in the future, that'd be great.
Excellent.
This item also is for information only. Any more questions, comments from anybody on the dais? Oh, Regent DelCarlo, please.
Thank you very much. Just want to thank you for such a great presentation. And it's good to understand all this. I don't disagree with any of it. I think it's, and the idea to do the Congressional Medal would be certainly an honorarium. But I really do like the idea of possibly going to some of the Indian casinos that have come into Nevada. I know in the past, the one that bought the Palms did a beautiful gift to UNLV. I mean, very large, substantial gift. So, you know, you never know until you ask. That's the way I look at stuff. So I think it's a great idea, though. Thank you.
Well said. Anyone else? Regent Cruz Crawford, please.
I would have to say that I do not agree with asking the Indian casinos to pay for the waivers. The whole point of the waiver is to help a disproportionately disadvantaged, I don't even like that word, population. So I'd just like to say that for the record, just like we don't ask the Nevada National Guard. I think that money should be given to us during this legislative session for waivers. Thank you.
Thank you. Regent Goodman.
I second those comments.
Well stated. Thank you, sir. Great
Thank
presentation.
You.
We appreciate it. Let's slide down to new business. Is there a new business from the committee? New business from, oh, there you are.
Oh, me neither.
Yeah, go ahead, Regent Downs.
Thank you, Chair Arascata. Jeff Downs for the record. So I really wasn't sure if I should talk about this here or in the regular meeting, but I did have the recent opportunity to attend the NSHE Mathematics Co-Requisite Conference hosted by CSN. Dr. Z had a great team do a good job there, and Alok Pandey was also a great organizer and put a good group together. So this was a chance for math faculty from across the state to get together and talk about how they're implementing the board-mandated co-requisite policy. And I won't get into a lot of detail, but I'm happy to talk to anyone about this if they ever want to talk about it. I'd like to see one school did a statistical analysis and presentation about how their students are doing with co-req. And I'd like to see that same type of analysis done at all the schools, if that's something that can be put on the agenda in the future, and both in the math and the English side.
Let's go ahead and do that. If you could provide more clarification.
Okay.
And maybe just at the conclusion of this meeting, that'd be helpful.
Okay.
Just exactly what you want to pinpoint.
Okay, yeah.
That'd be helpful. Regent Boylan?
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got to get used to this thing like everybody does. This is Patrick Boylan for the record. I forget, but what do you do? As you suggested, for new business, I think it's a grand idea that we approach the Native American casinos. They have lots of money, and like I said, they've just spent a lot of money here in Las Vegas. And I know Regent Crawford doesn't think it's a grand idea, but I do. So we've got to get the money from somewhere, and then maybe we can give you more for your National Guard, if we can, you know, this way and that way. So in new business, I'd like to say that can we have somebody to approach the casinos, maybe the chair or the chancellor, maybe the new chancellor? I have no idea. I have no problem going and approaching them if I'm given permission by the board or support. So that's something to think about, sir.
Thank you, Regent Boylan.
Thank you, sir.
Let's see how this session of legislature goes, and we'll continue the progress from there.
No, not the legislature. I'm talking about the casinos themselves.
No, I know that, sir. What I was saying is let's see what happens at the legislature this year.
Aye.
Or this session. And if there needs to be additional funds, both yours and Regent DeCarlo's suggestion will be unquestionably taken under consideration.
Outstanding. Thank
Excellent.
You, sir.
My pleasure. So I do have four items also. During our ARSA December 1st, 2022, agenda item number 8, the fees in which NSHE is compensated were not on the MOU. Although in December this was discussed, we need to provide some more information on a later date. Also, during the December quarterly meeting, Vice Chair Del Carlo requested a status update on the ME3 career exploration tool and how it's being used, as the ME3 was funded by the Rogers Foundation. Former Chair McAdoo also requested this information be presented at the full board as an information item to benefit the entire board. Also, for informational purposes, a presentation of NSHE institutional research under NSHE data dashboard, that would be extremely helpful. updating the data dashboard to provide more increased accurate information for everyone not on this room, but not just in this room, but everybody utilizing our INSHE website. That'd be extremely helpful. And lastly, an update reviewing the streamline of MOUs among INSHE institutions. Excellent. All right. In conclusion, I'm sorry. Regent Acardo, I apologize.
No problem. Were you done with yours?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, thank you. You asked me to put in a new business, so I would love to, I don't know how this is new business, but use that 95.4 transfer rate as our baseline and then have an annual update to where, you know, we get to 100 someday. We can't, if you don't measure it, it's not important. I mean, what we measure is important, so thank you.
Great statement. All right, we're going to slide down to item number 10, public comments. Is there any public comment up? Oh, excuse me. Regent Goodman, please.
I just would like to say I think that fundraising is something that happens institution, specific to institutions. And I believe that I do this for a living, and I do believe that if there's an opportunity to get money, the institutions should speak with varied private corporations on their own. That's what their fundraisers do, and that's a great way to approach getting money from large corporations here in our state. It's I think, incumbent on those varied fundraising departments per institution to do that work. So I would just like to clarify that and put that on the record.
Thank you, Regent Goodman. So let's slide over to public comment. Is there any public comment in Elko?
No public comment in Elko at this time.
Is there any public comment in Reno?
There is none in Reno.
Is there here under the beautiful campus of CSN? Yes, one public comment. Please.
Thank you. Good morning, board members. My name is Kat Furman for the record. I am a staff member at Nevada State College and a member of the Diversity and Inclusion Task Force. I am also the chair of the Native and Indigenous Peoples Coalition Subcommittee. I'm here before you today to advocate for expanding the fee waiver requirements for Native learners. The current requirements create restrictive obstacles that stand in their way. There are two main points that merit emphasizing as you consider your positions. First, the fee waiver is available only to registered members of the 27 recognized tribes in Nevada. The fee waiver should cover any Native learner who is a registered tribal member from any state in the Union. Current enrollment of Native learners at colleges in Nevada, and especially at NSC, are so small they can barely be measured. Offering the fee waiver to a registered member of any North American Native tribe will result not only in higher visibility of the college, but will also attract other students from diverse areas of the country, making our student population a rich and vibrant one. Second, currently Native learners can only receive the fee waiver after any federal benefits or grants have been applied. As a student, I'd be looking for every single way possible to pay for my education without going into debt. As you know, as of 2022, student loan debt burdens 43.5 million Americans. I myself have student debt, and it's an onus I will carry for years. As higher education professionals, we have an obligation to serve the needs of our students, the majority of which in Nevada are from historically minoritized communities. Native Americans have consistently been forgotten, disappeared, and underrepresented. They deserve to be visible. They deserve recognition. They deserve a free education. After all, we're on their historical lands. Thank you for your attention.
Very well stated. Thank you. Is there any more public comment in Las Vegas? And with that, I was just provide a significant reminder that one of the items I was remiss to do today was to provide a land acknowledgement. This land acknowledgement will reverberate throughout the state of Nevada, but also it is something that we're going to echo at all of our committee meetings in addition to our main board meeting tomorrow. So with that stated, we all should take a moment to recognize that here in Nevada, we stand on the Washishu, Washoe, the Numu, Northern Paiute, the Nui, Western Shoshone, and the Nuwu, Shoshone Paiute. We take a moment to recognize and honor their stewardship that continues today. With this recognition, we state an intention to rightfully include their voice and respect them as the 27 sovereign nations of Nevada. Public comment just did the same acknowledgement, and we should do that, and I apologize to all, not just online, but in this building today, that I did not give the public acknowledgement this morning. So thank you. Also, sitting up on the dais this morning, we have Linda King with legal counsel. We have Joel Becker with the Attorney General's Office and our Acting Chief of Staff, Carrie Nikolajewski. So I want to say thank you to all of them. And with that stated, nothing else on the agenda, no hands up. I'm going to hand this over to BFF Chair Amy Carvalho, Regent Carvalho, excuse me. And if we'll take a 10-minute administrative break, thank you much.